On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to A Conversation Hour, where today we're going to deal with one of the most difficult issues in our community. Twice as many people in Australia die from suicide than from the road toll. Twice as many people die from suicide rather than from the road toll. It's an astonishing state of affairs. In part, it's because we've made all sorts of progress after decades of trying on the road toll. But why aren't we doing something similar about the mental health crisis and people's decision to take their own lives? I have with me in the studio three people who are, in their own way and for their own reasons, and sometimes unfortunately become experts in this area. But they're here to tell personal stories as well as to help you with yours. What happens after suicide is the subject of a piece of performance, but it's thought-provoking performance of a kind that we rarely see. The project is called 2:20 AM. It's written by Rebecca Lister. It's to be performed at the Richmond Theatrette. It's on now, but it's really only an excuse or a trigger for us to talk about something that should not be in the too hard basket any longer. Rebecca Lister, the playwright, is one of my guests. Rebecca, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
And also here in the studio, Louise Flynn, psychologist from Jesuit Social Services, who works specifically in the area of support after suicide. And Louise, thank you for your expertise. Thank you. And also Penny Gibson, who's one of those who's contributed to this project called 2:20 AM. Penny, good morning to you.
Good morning, John.
Tell us your story.
Well, 11 and a half years ago, my son took his own life. He suffered from bipolar disorder. We had no inkling that this was going to happen, although looking back at photos that we took about a month earlier, he looks very serene, and I've heard that this is what happens to people when they are about to take their own lives. They have made the decision. So that happened, and I had been writing before that, and after that I couldn't write at all. I just had no words. And when I heard about this program that Rebecca ran, which was through Jesuit Social Services Support After Suicide, it was a writing program, I just leapt at that chance. I couldn't wait to enrol, and I'm so glad that I did that.
How did it help?
Well, the program ran over nine months, and we came once a week. And
for 9 months?
Yeah.
Every week?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a very big undertaking. Rebecca took us very slowly and very gently into the process. We weren't asked to talk about what had happened to us. We just were able to let that emerge through the writing exercises, and we gradually established trust and got to know each other. And there were people who'd lost children, partners, parents, the whole spectrum. And it was a really bonding experience. And at the end of it, amazingly, Rebecca managed to get us all with enough confidence to actually put on a performance. And it was marvellous. It was a fantastic experience.
Do you think something else might have helped you deal with your grief and all the issues in the same way?
I did see a counsellor for a number of months, a number of years, in fact, and that was certainly a great help. Subsequently, I've joined a choir, and I think that is something else that really helps me. But it was the experience of being gently held, if I can put it that way, while...
Not literally.
Not literally. No. In this room with Rebecca and the very straightforward writing exercises that you'd get in any writing group. But of course, we all had a story we really wanted to tell. And so we were able to let that emerge. And Rebecca was a really good listener, and she was, as I say, she held us very gently so that it was a safe place and we could do that.
We'll hear more from you, I'm sure. Rebecca, it sounds like a remarkable project. Where did the idea come from?
John, my brother, my eldest brother, suicided a number of years ago, and it was a very traumatic time. The day after he suicided, my second daughter was born, so I was thrown into this situation where I had life and death right in front of me, and I would swing. I'd have these swings where I'd have this great joy about this lovely baby. It was my second child, so I was more confident as a parent, and then I'd plummet with this terrible grief. And after my brother's funeral, my mum came and stayed with me, and it was a roller coaster, and I thought I need to do something with that. I was working as an artist back then, that, you know, about 24 years ago. But I also had to go and have counselling and talk through this about my own relationship with my brother and my family and his children. And then a number of years later, I started to work for as an artist for Jesuit Social Services, and I met Louise and the program Support After Suicide, and I went, I'd really like to do a project. I really want to do a creative project that's based around the gathering of stories, because I knew how important the writing of stories was for me during that period of time. And they were just things I did for my own personal sake. They weren't stuff that I published or anything. So I met with Louise and said, let's get a writer's program together and give people really good skills. The difference was that the writer's group was a writer's group. The activities are therapeutic, but it wasn't a therapeutic group. It was a writer's group. So giving people the opportunity to learn, to develop skills to write. And then we took the work and we produced an anthology of creative works. Then we decided to do a show at La Mama through their community program scheme. We did three shows and the tickets sold out in an hour, and we went, okay, this is pretty interesting. Then I did a few more projects with Louise and with Support After Suicide. And then we thought it would be really great if we could actually make a work for professional artists that can hold those stories, because asking community members and people who have lived experience to perform that work night after night is very exhausting.
You're asking them to go through something gruelingly emotional over and over again.
That's right. So we applied for funding. I spoke to Louise about what sort of work I'd like to write, what kind of play I'd like to write. I was doing my master's in playwriting at VCA at the time, and so I was kind of, you know, looking at things in a different way as a writer. And we applied for funding. I did a whole lot of interviews with people who had lost a family member or a loved one to suicide. Penny was one of my interviewees. And I wrote a play, and now the play's on. So that's really the background. But a lot of it, I think, stemmed from that experience at La Mama, where we made this work and we thought, oh, you know, a few people will come, family and friends, but we had this rush of interest. Actually, I think I came in here and spoke to you about that particular project, I think. Yeah, so it was, you know, that's where it all started.
Different people react and respond in different ways. There is no right or wrong, one of the things we've learned, and there's no timeline that's required either. Louise Flynn is a psychologist. She works in Support After Suicide at Jesuit Social Services and is the third member of my panel here to take your calls. One of the last taboos talking about suicide years ago, of course, the protocols in the media were that we just never mention it because of a fear of copycats. We've since learned that's not helped at all. It's better that it's out there and openly discussed, which is what we're doing today. 1300 222 774. Louise, thank you for joining us as well. How did you get into this field?
I was working about 15 years ago in a general bereavement counselling service. And so we would see people who'd lost someone from any kind of death. But what was really noticeable was that 30% of those who were coming to see us had lost someone to suicide. So it really spoke of an extraordinary need. And so we started running groups, and I think it was just really noticing that there was this extraordinary complex suffering which was completely invisible, and in fact there wasn't anything being done in response. So that's where that's really started, I guess.
Self-evidently, a death by suicide is different to any other bereavement. What are the hallmarks? What do you typically see?
I think suicide, losing someone to suicide, is complex because there's the grief, as there is in many other deaths.
That's common.
That's common.
Yeah.
There's also a level of trauma. It's a very traumatic experience. Again, that's common to some other deaths. I think there's also people still experience suicide as stigmatising. So there's a sense that people will steer clear of them, avoid them.
Of the bereaved.
And also that then judgment of the person who's died. People don't know how to speak about what's happened. They don't know how to speak to the family. They don't know how to speak about the person who's died.
They don't know the words.
Which is why I think these projects are so important, to finding the words, finding a means of expression. But people don't know what to say, and sometimes people don't know a lot about suicide, so they tend to have simplistic ideas about it, then tend to be judgmental. And so I think the other thing, though, with suicide is the nature of the death. The fact that someone has actually entered their own life then does mean some very difficult experiences for those left behind. The wondering about how come they didn't see it, the feelings of guilt, very, very difficult experiences. And, that creates a level of complexity which is very painful and very difficult to find words for.
I'm trying to think of my own experiences, as I'm sure all the thousands of people who are listening. I don't know how universal this is, but Penny, of people I've known, when I've heard how they died, it's always been, did I miss something? Could I have made a difference? Is that the way a parent feels too?
My husband certainly felt like that, because our son had been ill for a number of years, diagnosed for about 12 years, and my husband had once been there with him, and he had sat there with him when he was curled up in acute pain and stayed with him until he came through that. And so he, more than I, felt a great burden of responsibility that he had not seen this coming this time. I don't think that it affected me in quite the same way.
That means you not only have your grief, but you also...
Huge guilt.
You have guilt.
Yeah, huge guilt. And for us, we were fortunate because our son was 41. He didn't live at home. We were not responsible for his well-being.
Or
his daily care. Yeah. And I know people where that was not the case, where their child lived at home and ended their lives. And that is, I don't think you would ever recover from, I don't think you recover from it anyway, but that's such an extra level of pain.
And Rebecca, you were in an extraordinary position. You're about to have a baby. So your mind is anywhere except thinking, I suppose, about your brother.
Absolutely. And I mean, I went through those feelings of guilt. My brother was quite troubled towards the end of his life and making lots of phone calls and wanting things. But I also had a 17-month-old as well, so I had a lot on my plate. And towards the end, I'd stopped returning calls, and I wouldn't. This was back when we had an answering machine. I'd delete the messages, and it was an awful feeling, a terrible feeling of guilt. I felt ashamed that I had not been. I have a social work degree. I've worked in as a social worker as well as an artist, so I have an understanding of human nature and compassion. And I felt that I lacked compassion at that time. But everything is contextualized. Everything sits within a context, and you have to work through that process of going, I am not to blame. This is someone's decision. But yeah, it was. I think it's the shock too, that I can still clearly remember the moment that I heard what had happened and what I did and what I said and my response. And I've had the same conversation with one of my other brothers, and they're able to identify that moment. My parents shut down, actually. My dad was very angry and very ashamed, and he died a year later and was very unresolved. And it took my mum about 20 years to work through it. It took her a long time. I actually wrote this play. I come from Mount Isa in northwest Queensland, and I went back to Mount Isa to care for my mum in her last few years, and I wrote this play in my brother's old bedroom. Actually, it had been changed into a sunroom study, so I was sitting in there, and my mum, who was in her early 90s, was in the lounge room, and she'd hear me doing the interviews, because I did a lot of the interviews via Skype and on the phone, and then I'd talk to mum about what I was writing. And she didn't talk a lot about it, but we got to a point where we could talk about it, because she too shut down. It was a grief caused her to. She was of that era where you didn't speak about things and where grief would cause you to shut down. So.
Yeah, well, it's not surprising. Yeah. And just before we get to callers, Rebecca Lister, you were just hearing there, who's the playwright of the production we're talking about, 2:20 a.m. And Penny Gibson, you heard from, whose son suicided in 2007, I think he said, correct. Just over 10 years ago, is one of the contributors. And our third guest, Louise Flynn, psychologist from Jesuit Social Services, is here. Louise, just before we get to calls, what are the statistics proportionally? Is it not true that considerably more men take their own lives than women?
That's right, John. It's 3/4 of those who take their lives in Australia are men. So it's a significant proportion, yeah.
Why?
That's actually a very complex question, I think, and many, many people have tried to work this out. Some people would put it down to, women's are easier with relationships, finding connection. And some men...
And asking for help.
And asking for help. And
men think they're bulletproof, they're stoic, yeah. They don't ask anyone for anything,
yeah.
Ever.
And that asking for help is a sign of weakness. I should be able to do this on my own. I should be able to manage this. So it's,
I fix other people's problems.
Yeah, that's right. So the sense of identity, I guess, about masculinity... is
I'm not
one
giving
of
too much
things.
Away about myself anymore.
Not at all.
You're all looking at me as if you're going, oh, God. But the other issue, and this comes up from time to time, Louise, is that men are more readily able to access the sorts of things that help you to end your life, by which I mean guns, fast cars, a lot of car accidents, single car hits a tree. And a lot of the time people say, well, we don't know. It's called a car crash. I've got texts already saying a lot of the road toll, in fact, a significant proportion of the road toll may well be people who are deciding to use that method of ending their life.
On the road toll statistics, if a death is known to be suicide, it's not included in those road toll statistics. It's included in the suicide statistics. But, yes, there may be a small number. I think one of the things that makes, when you're talking about means of suicide, is that men are more, would have less fear about harming themselves. And so I think that's one thing that's talked about as being, making men more likely perhaps to have a higher suicide rate. They're going to be more comfortable, for want of a better way of putting it, with the means of suicide.
1300 222 774. Rebecca, Penny and Louise are here in the studio, and let's start with Maureen in Collingwood. Good morning to you, Maureen.
Oh, hi, John. I'll turn this radio off.
That would be very
yes.
good.
Sorry. I had two brothers that committed suicide, and what I thought might be interesting, they both shot themselves through the head, so very violently. What was interesting, perhaps, for people to know is things have changed in reaction. 1975, my parents didn't get one card of condolence. It was just incredible how people just didn't... It was just so hurtful, particularly for my mother. And by 1990...
Is this when your two brothers... The gap between one and then the second one. So your first brother took his own life in 1975.
Yeah, yeah.
And the second one, 1990.
In 1990, people were overwhelming with their cards and letters, and feelings were able to talk about it. And I think, I just thought that was interesting.
Oh, it's more than interesting. What do you put it down to, Maureen?
Just programs, perhaps like this. Perhaps people have learnt more about it, and people forget now. I think how in the past things were just pushed under the carpet, you know. And now it's so good that things are allowed to be talked about. Yeah, and congratulations on your play. It sounds sounds great. But I would, the other one thing I would say is that it's not always about hugely visible mental diseases like bipolar. I mean, I'm very sorry for the lady there speaking, but my brothers were not bipolar. There's an awful lot of despair out there,
yeah,
and particularly amongst men. And it goes way back to childhood and the way their fathers treated them and the brutality of their lives, the beltings and anger. You know, the way men have been brought up is very much a part of it, and how there is no outlet, yeah.
Maureen, thank you. You've touched on many aspects of it, and Penny, even in the time since your family were affected, things have changed again.
Rebecca. Yes, yes.
Sorry, Penny.
Actually, it's an interesting phone call from Maureen. When my brother died, I received very little condolence from people, and I felt, and I, many of my friends were tertiary educated, they worked in social justice, they worked in mental health, but they shut down, and because I'd had this baby as well,
yep,
a second child, there was some response to that, but I remember writing a piece saying, you know, where are the casseroles? Where are the casseroles? Nobody brought me anything, and that exacerbated that feeling of isolation. There were a few people that came out of the woodwork, and I really, you know, treasured their ability to be able to come and speak with me, but they shut down. So, and I think for my parents, my father operated on the kind of like the 6-week model. You grieve for 6 weeks and then it's done. He would say to my mother, it's done. It's finished. We don't grieve anymore. And that's very painful. That's a very painful way to operate, yes.
Thank you, Maureen. I really appreciate your call. Jill in Malvern. Morning to you, Jill.
Hi, John, and your guest. Yes, my son suicided the May the 19th, 2014. I went overseas for a month, and then I thought, well, he's, you know, and I was his carer from when he was 10 years of age, you know, as with bipolar, and he's married and had a little boy, 2 and a half, and I thought his wife and his little boy, he'll be all right, you know, because he pleaded with me not to go. And then I came home, and it was Mother's Day, and I had that little family of three and my daughter and her family for Mother's Day, and he apologized to my daughter for the way he'd treated her. And I didn't know he'd done that. If I'd known that, I would have known it was a signal, because people who suicided do the most meticulous ending off of things, paying back a debt of, you know, 50 cents that they had 3 years ago, or taking a library back that they'd stolen from the school library, you know, 6 years ago. I have evidence of those things in my daughters and sons when they were both in year 11 at different stages. Each had a year 10 person that they knew who was brilliant in some way, suicide. So, you know, they knew the signals that are coming. And I've actually had two students in my long teaching life tell me that I stopped them from suiciding.
By noticing what, by seeing the signs?
Well, helping them, you know, getting accommodation for one, and making sure that she had medicine for genital herpes so that she could ride to school, and, you know, on and on. And then I soldiered on for a year after my son died, and, you know, looking after my daughter and my daughter-in-law and my grandchild and my husband especially, who was so, you know, that he was his best friend. Anyway, after a year, I had a breakdown, and I vomited constantly for 12 weeks and lost 18 kilos. And then the principal started, you know, I was, you know, in my early 70s then, and the principal started bullying me. I had to, because when you're away from education department for 12 weeks, you have to have an education department doctor, you know,
yes,
look at you. And that, there's no education department doctor. Now the school chooses a doctor to examine,
sure,
you.
Sure, so the workforce issues became relevant as well. Jill, I want to pick up on some of the clues you gave us there with Louise. Are there signs, typically, that we can look out for someone who's becoming vulnerable?
sometimes after someone's ended their life, people will look back and understand that some behaviour or some action probably was a sign. It's just that before, it can be very difficult to know that that is a sign, because sometimes the things that happen can be sort of quite ordinary. And the things that Jill has mentioned can certainly be an indication. For instance, giving away objects, certain phone calls, certain texts, paying back debts, those kinds of things can be
Penny
indications.
Penny talked about the serenity.
Yes, that's right, in his face. And we must have observed it at the time, but we didn't realise until we looked at the photos afterwards.
Didn't know what it meant.
No, didn't know what it meant.
So, I mean, you know, we can all be more finely tuned is what we're learning here, and maybe that might make a difference. Cheryl in Hampton. Hello, Cheryl. Welcome to our forum.
Hi, John. I spoke to you about this time last year, I think.
We have touched on this issue from time to time, and we think that's a good thing. I hope it is.
About 2 months ago, I was really ready to do it, and I thought that people around me understood me better, because I had to actually stand up in front of a group of people and say, I'm going to kill myself before somebody noticed. And that's amongst people who should have picked it up.
So you asked for help effectively?
I did.
And did you get it?
It took 6 weeks to get somebody to talk to. And because mine is, with all the stuff that's happened over the last couple of years with child abuse, things were coming back to me that I hadn't remembered. And when it hit really badly.
Yep.
And I thought, what about the people who were not institutionally abused, but were abused anyway? We have no recompense. We have no way of resolving things. Our parents or abusers may have died. And we have no way to understand why. Why did that happen to me?
And sometimes there's no answer, of course, Cheryl.
Of course there isn't. But, I mean, I've found an excellent person who really is getting at the very point of the issue. And I'm so grateful for that. And people say now, since the event, that they know that if I start talking about having someone take care of my cats, then I'm serious. And I try to make the point to them that it's before that that's important.
Yep, there's no doubt about that. Cheryl, thank you. And we remind people, of course, Lifeline 13 11 14 or Seek Help, and general practitioners these days are much better equipped to deal with these issues than ever before and can refer you on to psychologists and services that may make a difference. Wayne in Christmas Hills. Hello, Wayne.
Yeah, g'day. Just about suicide with men or men being bulletproof or tough. I'm 60-odd, and I've been brought up a post-feminist male, and I had feminist school teachers, and I just learned it wasn't cool to be a man at all, so spent my whole life being, I delivered my children at birth, and being as paternal and loving and female, I guess, but, the father that everybody wants, but I found after going through the family court or whatever, society isn't prepared for men like that, and the stereotyping, you know, my advice would be just don't have kids, because if you have kids, you'll have your children. There's a new stolen generation, and if the stolen generation is children are stolen away from their fathers, and they might have a relationship with them, you know, once a fortnight.
So you've been bruised by the family court, by the sound of it, Wayne.
Oh, well, the magistrate court said to me, how dare I accuse a mother of family violence?
Well, that's another issue for another day, but I take your point.
So you seek help, and when you go out there, the systems for men don't exist.
Well, certainly the whole issue, and several texters have also sent in texts saying that a breakdown in a family relationship is very often a trigger. Work crises, I've got people texting in about the drought and the crisis in the rural economy at the moment as well. I mean, all of these things, Louise, these are all alarm bells that ring for us.
Yes, many relationships end without it resulting in suicide, but it is often a precipitating event or a trigger event for men. And I think that sometimes that's about earlier life experiences of loss and grief, but it's also the loss of role, loss of connection with family, the isolation, social isolation that brings, and the feelings of powerlessness, I think.
And, yes, the issues, child sexual abuse was mentioned by our caller Cheryl before.
Yes.
There can be, and if it's not well dealt with, there can be events in your life that are the defining feature in your life.
Mm.
If you don't deal with it, then, yes, it can fester away sometimes for years.
Mm.
We've learned that too from the Royal Commission.
That's right. And as Cheryl was saying, sometimes later events in life can cause it to sort of be triggered, and then it's quite overwhelming. And then people can feel very alone and really not know what to do.
And we've heard that about post-traumatic stress disorder from military service and combat, from war, from major criminal events. We've seen all sorts of things.
Yes.
We're learning a lot about our soul in a contemporary world, are we not?
Definitely.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I've got texts from here saying, look, you know, when my beloved, we went to church and at the funeral the priest said that their soul was going to be forever in purgatory because of the manner of their death, which just compounded the grief, in particular for my religious parents was this particular text.
Yeah,
it seems
terrible.
That was the old teaching in the church.
Mm.
I'd like to think that doesn't happen anymore, but I don't really know. It's not my world. John Fain with you. We're having a talkback forum today about after suicide. Rebecca Lister is a playwright, and together with a group of people, including Penny Gibson, who's here, they've come up with a production called 2:20 AM. And Louise Flynn is a psychologist, manager of the Support After Suicide Service at the Jesuit Social Services, who's generously agreed to come in and help us with the talkback on this delicate topic today. Melanie in Fryerstown. Morning to you, Melanie.
Hello, John. Hello, Rebecca. And I can't remember everyone else's name. But
Penny and Louise.
Hello. Penny and Louise. Hello.
Hello.
My mum, hello, Rebecca. My mum, Margaret Cameron, was part of that play.
Oh, yes.
But La Mama.
Yes, and we know Margaret. Yes.
She loved that play. Sorry, I get emotional.
Mm.
Because it helped her. She was so lonely in that grief. And sorry, I'm breathing deeply.
You take your time if you need to, Melanie.
Yeah, but I went to see the play. Oh, it was just fantastic what people shared and the response from the audience. It was a very spiritual experience, I suppose.
And what did it... That you've told us what it was like for Margaret. What was it like for Melanie, for you?
For me? Well, it was affirming that, you know, you're not alone when you're dealing with your sadness and your grief, because that's what suicide leaves people feeling, that you do feel so alone. And I remember Mum shut down and I heard other people talking about that, and I'm not that sort of person. I don't shut down, I talk and talk about things, but the play just helped me understand where my mother was coming from and how other people were affected by it. But it just shows that people coming together in that creative way gives people a voice that they wouldn't find otherwise.
Terrific. Melanie, thank you so much. I've got some... Look, I can't read all these text messages, and people have clearly crafted them hoping they'll get read out, and I'm really, really sorry. I could read text messages pretty much from here until the 12 o'clock news, but obviously there's people a full board of calls as well, so I'll read a few. My brother took his own life 7 years, 1 month, 2 weeks and 4 days ago. I mean, that tells you everything, doesn't it, already?
Yes.
There were no signs. He was the life of the party. He meticulously planned his end. I remember the dinner I was cooking when the phone call came, and I've never cooked that dinner since. I'll never get past this. I'll try and get there. The place sounds wonderful. In the pre-social media era, I was with a group of grieving young people after a friend suicided. They didn't know, they said. Then they found out he'd visited every one of them in the last month. Mm. He said, always, I'll see you later. Every other time he visited, but this time he simply said goodbye. So there were signs, but we didn't know. Thank you for helping raise awareness. City of Monash has been doing a number of things with Headspace for ages. We've met with Greg Hunt, the health minister, who said he would consider a facility. And we need support. We need more political support. And that's from a councillor, Stuart James, from the City of Monash. Thank you, says Liz in Sale. This topic has to be covered, and we need to respect people. When relationships end, often men are the first to try and find another loving person. With suicide, it's because they feel there is no one there for them. And this may help, but having loving families and relationships is absolutely vital in our complex world. Anne's in the city. Thanks for holding on. Good morning, Anne.
Oh, good morning. I've just come out of hospital from having had thoughts of suicide. And everybody was really very helpful. But I was very, very, very scared. And I knew my thoughts weren't right. And I went and asked for help, and I was given it.
You were given help, Anne, straight away?
Yeah, straight away.
Fantastic. How are you? And you're okay? You're on a more even keel now?
Pretty even keel. I'm a bit teary just making the phone call. But apart from that, I've been home for about a few days. Not very long, but the support I received in the hospital, which was the psychiatric hospital, and in the emergency department, was very, very good.
And are you post-release getting ongoing support too, Anne?
I'm able to get access to ongoing support, and I've got a whole lot of network around, and this was the first time this had ever happened to me.
I hope it's the one and only and last time, of course, Anne. Look, great to hear someone who is happy with the services, because goodness knows, Louise, we hear a lot of people saying they're not happy with the services, don't we?
We do. We hear many, many stories of where people have felt let down. But what Anne's referring to there too is that there has been more money put into providing post-discharge support for people who have attempted or are thinking or have been thinking about suicide. So we're hoping that there's a real change.
We certainly are. Yes, Penny.
I just wanted to say that one of my daughters also has a psychiatric illness, and she originally was in the Alfred, and it was not a good experience, but subsequently, I think 3 years ago, she was there and it was a completely different place. Her psychiatrist recommended she go there, not anywhere private. She said, you'll get the best care there. The psychiatrist and the nursing staff consulted me about how I thought she was going. And I know that a lot of people have done a lot of work at the Alfred, working with the doctors to try and enlighten them to the fact that the family is really important in supporting people.
So that's bearing fruit quite clearly. Let's grab Lynn from Ocean Grove. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm ringing because I've unfortunately lost both my sons, one through suicide at 15 and the other in 2009 through a rare cancer that's unheard of. And so I've had both experiences, and I would have to say that the suicide, both of them cause a lot of grief and angst and but the questions, why, and the shock and the numbness and the incapacity to go on with my daily life after the suicide of my 15-year-old was very, very telling. I was totally incapacitated. And you can't just take 2 weeks off work because the shock is such that I couldn't function for 6 months or more. This occurred because in 1985 there wasn't the support services there are now, and my son had an undiagnosed mental illness, and also we understand that he was a victim of sexual abuse at school.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Lynn, how does Lynn from Ocean Grove move on? How do you get to a point in your life after double grief where you can deal with the challenges of the world every day?
Well, I've actually sought, like one of your other callers mentioned, I've sought to actually talk to others about the experience. I have a strong network of friends, and it wasn't the suicide. I definitely didn't bounce back. It was a it was 33 years now, but it was at least a 20-plus year journey.
Goodness.
Of grief and confusion and trauma and that emptiness inside that, you know, we feel. I know you've got lots of callers, so I don't want to go on, but what I'd like to give a message of hope to those mothers and fathers who have lost children to suicide, young children particularly, that the pain is huge and it's relentless. And it's really important if someone doesn't reach out to you that you reach out to someone, and hopefully someone good, and that you have the opportunity to share your pain with others. The other thing I'd like to mention, and I think this is something that had I known, I didn't know anyone who had suicided, and I didn't know any parent who'd lost a child to suicide. So I was a bit of an oddball in the community, my husband and I. The other thing that I think is important to understand, that ultimately the loss is integrated into your soul and you can continue on, but you're a different person.
Yep.
And that's sort of the message that of hope, that you will be able to continue on with your life, you will be able to give to others, and even being able to share that experience is giving to others.
Wow. Rebecca?
Well, I think that's very much the essence of this particular play of 2:20 AM, is that it is about that sense of being able to integrate this experience as part of your narrative. It is part of your narrative, and you will understand it and experience maybe it for your whole life. But you can go on with dignity. You can live a life that is a dignified life that hopefully can be free of the stigma and the shame and the guilt. And that's one of the things that we certainly are exploring in this piece of theatre. I mean, this is not a piece of theatre that's didactic. We don't have a message. We're not banging anyone over the head. There's humour in it. It's moments are there's shades of light and dark. It's a whole lot of different things. We're not pretending that we have the entire answer. But I think that Lynn's call is very pertinent, because it is that sense of being able to live a life of dignity and to go, I can move on, and I don't have to resolve this completely. It's part of my narrative, but I can live a life of dignity.
I simply can't get all of your calls to air, and it's impossible to hear from you all, but let's move to Chris in Noble Park. Hello, Chris.
Oh, g'day, John, Penny, Louise and Rebecca.
Welcome.
I just was listening, and every few months you guys, well, not you guys, but you, John, bring up suicide and how it affects people in different ways. And I just wanted to make the point of how, sort of leading up to it, during it, and after it, it's really hard to get help, like really hard. So my experience was, and I'm a little bit upset, which I hate being, you know.
Sorry about that, Chris, but...
My experience was, I came home and had a little argument with my partner and found a whole heap of letters that were really disturbing. So I went to a police station and asked for help. And I rang the CAT team, and they said they were too busy to help me. And the people in the police station, the two blokes there, had a bit of a laugh and a chuckle and said, "Oh, don't worry, mate, that's just what women do, you know." So I went home and she'd hung herself in the shed.
Oh, God. I'm sorry to hear that tale, Chris. How long ago was all of this?
This was in 2001, I think.
Yep.
And
I'd like to think that we'd deal with it better today, do you think?
I don't know how it's dealt with today, but no. I do take a lot of note when you talk about it on the radio, and I talk about it generally because I found the best way to deal with it was to get in an interstate truck and take a shitload of drugs and just drive all around the countryside. But it doesn't matter how much you hurt yourself physically or emotionally or anything, it doesn't change what's happened, you know.
So that didn't work. But I hope you're not doing that anymore.
Oh, God, no. I stopped doing all that, and I wish I could give up cigarettes, but that's pretty hard anyway.
It certainly is, and I can well understand why you might have your mind elsewhere. So, Chris, what advice do you give to the many, many people who are listening?
That's advice is really hard, isn't it? And it's so subjective, you know. For most people, from the stories we hear, and like a shout-out to Lynn from Ocean Grove, that was a horrible story. I met people all around the country, John. I met a farmer once in Dubbo, and I was really upset on the day, and he told me that his son and his daughter had committed suicide in the farm shed because of how depressed he was. And the advice you give people, I mean, you know, what Lynn said was kind of true. You know, you do get on with your life, and but you never stop forgetting. And when you cry out for help, like my experience was, it was really empty crying out for help, you know.
Would you ask for help again now if you needed help?
I don't ask for help for anything, ever.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't go to any government department or anything for any help at all.
I wish that wasn't your answer, Chris.
Yeah, so do I, John. But your experience is hard to... It's really hard to... You really only have your experience to draw on. And all the way down to... I did try to talk to somebody once, and I fronted up. They said you could drop in any day, you know, if you're having a bad day. So I dropped in, and they told me that I shouldn't drop in because all I'd done was scare everybody there because I was so upset. And I thought to myself, well, you know, maybe you should try it from this side of the fence, you know.
Of course. Do you get any professional help now, Chris, even though it's many years ago?
No.
Would you try again?
No, I wouldn't. No, I just work now.
Have you found other ways of dealing with it? I mean, I often, on this radio program that I have, I often talk about how, you know, the best form of therapy for me is the shed, and it's cheaper than a shrink, is the phrase I use.
Well, we've spoken to each other before, John, and I've told you that I rebuild and fix old Land Cruisers, and it must have been only in the last 2 or 3 years, a bit longer, probably when I stopped smoking pot, but when I realised that I think the reason one of the reasons I passionately keep building Land Cruisers is because me and her were building a Land Cruiser to go around the country, and that's what she jumped off to hang herself, you know. So being in the shed is certainly a good one.
Well, a lot of, you know, car clubs do a lot of good in the community, and one thing they do is provide people who otherwise won't talk about these things with an environment where sometimes they do.
Yeah, talking's a hard thing, though. Like, it has to come from you, the talking, you know. You can't be sat down, as it were, and talk to. The subjective person actually needs to want to talk. So.
Well, if I see you at a swap meet, or you see me, more to the point, Chris, make yourself known.
Oh, yeah, I'll say g'day.
Do. And look, I think there's no one formula, you know, Louise. Different people find help in different ways in different places.
That's right.
People go to the footy and let off steam.
That's right. And activities is sometimes one of the best things to do, and particularly activities that mean you connect with other people. Doesn't mean you have to talk about what's happened, but just a feeling of being understood.
Connectedness.
Connected, belonging.
Here's my tribe.
Yeah.
These people understand me, no one else does.
Very helpful.
Absolutely. It completely makes sense to me. Chris, big hug to you.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Man hug.
What you're saying about community, though, is you've actually got to have faith in it to put your hand out to it, you know.
And if you've got a good 100 series with Bund or Standard, all original...
Oh, no, John, come on. These are 40 series.
Oh, you're going right back. All right. Good on you and take care. Hey, I'm going to move on. Is that okay?
Yeah, see you, folks. Bye.
Take care.
See you. Thanks, Chris.
Bye, Chris.
Shane in Thornbury. Hello, Shane. We're running out of time, but good morning.
John, just want to echo Chris's point. It's really hard to get help. We're right in the middle of it. My son attempted suicide this week.
This week?
Absolute shock. This week.
Oh.
No signs. The kid's been bullied for his school years. All the way through, changed schools and done whatever we can. But the point is, it was a lightning bolt. The counsellor called us, explained what had just happened. Apparently he'd attempted the day before. He failed. we were told by the council to go to the hospital. We took him to the Austin Hospital, waited for 5 hours for him to see a mental health specialist. Was sent home, brought him home.
Sorry, you were sent home without seeing someone?
No, we did see someone.
You did get to see, but it took a 5 hour wait. Okay.
It did, yeah. So about one in the morning or thereabouts, came home, keeping an eye on him as we were told to. The next day, I called the CAMHS people, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service, I think they are. It's all new tasks. We'd never heard about these departments or anything like that before, because I hadn't heard from them, and it was about 10 or 11 in the morning. What we got from them was a phone conversation with myself and my wife, and we've been told that it's going to take days to weeks, verbatim, in order for him to see someone from that system. In the public system.
Can you afford to go private, Shane?
I can. I was told, I did. We took him to the GP as well the next day, who knows us. The GP said that the CAMHS people are the best in the field.
They might be, but that's a long wait.
It is.
I mean, I hate the fact, I absolutely hate the fact that we have this divide in healthcare, in particular mental health care. I hate the fact that we have a two-tiered system in education, in, you know, every facet of our lives these days. I used to think that we didn't have that, but it's not the time to quibble about it, Shane. It's the time to get the help you need, isn't it?
That's right. There was no sign. That's the other thing I want to say to the listeners. He looked absolutely fine. I've been dropping him off at school and back. Couldn't see a thing, but so when it happens, you're not prepared for it. You think that the help's going to be there when you call for it, and it just isn't.
Are you getting the help you need right now, Shane?
We're together with him. We've been told to keep an eye on him, to stay with him, and I'm just trying to work my way through it. This has happened literally in the past couple of days.
Is there anything we can do for you if I pop you back to my producers, or are you under control?
If there is something you can do, I would really appreciate it.
I'll pop you back and have a chat to John right now. That's all we've got time for, but it leaves people waiting who have undoubtedly got equally compelling stories to tell, for which I'm just awfully sorry, but we just can't keep on beyond the 12 o'clock news, which is almost upon us. Penny, Rebecca, Louise, it's been remarkable. Louise, we've learned about where there are gaps in the system. We've learned about telltale signs. Mm. In summation, what advice do you give people if they're concerned for someone?
The avenues really are to go to a GP and to get a referral to a psychologist. Also, there's a telephone line called Suicide Callback Service and Suicide Line, which is very helpful. Yeah, I think the GP, but it's just there are gaps in the service, and we just need to acknowledge that.
The system is far from perfect. Penny, Rebecca, congratulations on the collaboration with so many people and on your play. And thank you all so much for coming in.
Thank you, John. Thank
and you, if you John. Need help, Lifeline 13 11 14. Kids Helpline exists. Talk to your GP or talk to someone you love or trust. Anyone in the community who you think you can talk to, and as we heard from Chris, it might be your mates in the shed talking about restoring old Land Cruisers. For goodness sake, anything is better than nothing. And thank you indeed for your calls and your texts, many of which have been moving and some of which have left me almost not able to get through. On your ABC, this has been The Conversation Hour.